Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by my firm, Herity & Herity, the go-to firm for the PAN 300 for PAN preparation and prosecution. Today, we're lucky to be joined by Josh Landau, PAN Counsel at Computer and Communications Industry Association, CCIA, one of the most publicly vocal advocates for limiting PAN rights in IT and software sectors. Josh also broke the news about Senator Leahy taking over the chair of the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on IP. Thank you so much for joining, Josh.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I guess the first question I always like to ask people is, do you remember when you first learned about patents and what was your impression, I guess, about their role?
So I actually came to it from a slightly different avenue than I think a lot of people who got into patents. I was an engineer in undergrad. I was an electrical engineer. But I also worked at the student radio station, and this was during the DMCA and during the initial application of sort of performance rights to radio, to streaming radio. So we were streaming at the time. We were an early web streamer, and I was part of station management when we were figuring out, okay, what do we do about this new requirement for tracking and payments and all of that? So that actually piqued my interest in IP. And then I started reading more about it, and the SCO patent and copyright fight over Unix also piqued my interest back when. So I think that's kind of where I came into the interest in IP, the interest in patents. And then as an engineer, worked at an automotive supplier at Motorola at the time, later Continental, filed a patent while I was there on a transmission control system method. Yeah.
So did you have any first impressions about the role patents played?
My first impressions were probably somewhat negative, given the SCO Unix litigation and the immense hassle that trying to figure out how to deal with the web streaming requirements was. But then working at Motorola, it was a more positive impression over an understanding of sort of the role that patents play in development and how they can be useful. So I think I saw it from both sides early on before I became a lawyer.
How were patents useful to Motorola?
They were definitely viewed as a competitive tool to prevent competitors from doing the same things as we were doing to make our products more valuable to our customers. As an engineer, they were a nice way to be recognized for your contributions, both sort of from a performance perspective and a financial perspective. Like many companies, they gave a financial reward for invention disclosures. But there was also a recognition while I was there that some things shouldn't be patented, that for competitive reasons, you're better off not patenting them. Or even just doing a defensive publication. Patents are a useful tool, but they're not the only tool. And that's something I think I've taken to heart in the policy conversation.
So you became a patent attorney and went to work on for WilmerHale, which I think in the patent space is probably most famous for representing Apple, including in the famous Apple versus Samsung litigation. Steve Jobs was maybe rightfully very angry that Apple basically created the smartphone market and Samsung, I think in his view, just copied what Apple did. And after many years of litigation, they finally settled. Some observed for a relatively modest sum, if you think of how much billions were at play. I don't know if you were involved in that, but I guess, can you tell us, how is your view of the patent system, I guess, impacted by doing patent litigation?
So I was at Wilmer during Apple Samsung, although I did not work on the case. And Samsung is a CCIA member, so I'll plead the fifth on discussing that particular case. But mostly I was representing people who had been accused of infringing. Usually when I looked into it, it was not a particularly meritorious accusation.
Yeah. I just want to talk about the role of CCIA. Obviously, it's made up of different technology companies who are also members of other organizations. I think, for example, Intel is members of CCIA. HTIA is the High Tech Inventors Alliance and the Business Software Alliance. What do you see as the role of a CCIA in the patent debate?
So CCIA has been around for about 40 years. And like you said, we represent a variety of technology companies, both hardware and software. Intel is one of them. Samsung, as I said, is one of them. Since the beginning, CCIA has really focused on free competition, open markets, open systems, on the ability to compete fairly and equitably, but not to have that competition restrained unduly. And I think in the patent space, our role is really a recognition of the balance that the patent system has to perform. It has to provide protection. It's not that patents are always bad, but it also has to promote progress. It has to not cut off innovation. And it's not that patents are always good. that balancing act is really what we try to achieve, is a recognition that patents have a role to play. But like I said earlier, patents aren't the only tool, and sometimes they're not the right tool. And sometimes they're applied in ways that are damaging to the innovation system.
How do you see your role versus, for example, Business Software Alliance lobbies on these similar issues, HCIA? I imagine you guys work together, but how do you see what CCIA does, what you do, kind of fitting in?
So I think a lot of it is just different memberships. We have overlap with HCIA, with BSA, but we don't have perfect overlap, and our members are going to have different interests. So sometimes you're going to have a case where we can take a position that somebody else can't, or vice versa, because of disparate member interests. At the end of the day, we are, they're not clients, but we are representing our members' interests in the policy sphere.
How does that work with your membership? Do you identify a patent policy issue and then kind of talk to the different member organizations to see what position CCI should take on that?
It depends, I think, is the answer. In some cases, it's I see an issue and I say to members, okay, this is what's going on. What do you think? Some of it is just ongoing discussions with members about what's going on in their IP sphere, what issues are coming up for them. So it's a give and take. It's understanding what their concerns are so that I can make judgments about what might be interesting to them, but also discussing with them, here's what's going on and what should we do? Obviously, we're making these decisions with member input. They're not member controlled in the sense of a member is not going to say, do this and we go do it. It's a mutual negotiation of what would be the right position, and CCIA will take the position that's consistent with our history, I think is really the key.
Do you think the members have an interest in different organizations that they're part of taking slightly different positions?
I don't know. Honestly, that's a member question. They certainly aren't saying to me, okay, we want you to do this and we're going to have somebody else do this. It's here's what we're talking about today. It's here's what's of interest to us. And we take the positions we're going to take based on member input, certainly. If those differ slightly from another organization, I suspect that it's more to do to different membership compositions, different interests, and just different histories for those organizations. And in some cases, perhaps different overlap between other issues they work on. As an example, CCIA is not particularly active on trademarks. Some of those other organizations are. We're very active on standard essential patents. Some of those other organizations are not. So there may be concerns from other issue areas that don't apply to other associations that do apply to us, or vice versa, that influence how we approach the patent question. Because it's not, CCIA is not patent exclusive. You know, we're active in a lot of areas, antitrust, privacy, telecommunications, just to name a few. Intermediary liability is a big one, obviously.
I mean, your views in that patents are bad, it's really about bringing the right balance to the patent system. Are there examples where CCIA has taken a position where for stronger patent rights or for easier to enforce patent rights?
I'm not going to speak to our entire history. The past few years have not been generally in that direction, given where the state of the current law is. What we've advocated for recently is clearer patent rights in particular. I think that that helps with enforcement, that helps with the lack of a need to enforce. It's expensive to go to a patent lawyer, as you and I both know. It's expensive to go and say, okay, what's up with this patent? Like, does my product infringe? Do I need to take a license? And to the extent we can clarify patents, to the extent that we can improve the quality of patents coming out there, that actually reduces the need for that sort of litigation and discussion. You know, our members license patents when it's an appropriate thing to do. I've advised people in the past, license this patent. There's not a license or design around in some cases. But at the end of the day, the more we can bring clarity to the patent system, the better enforcement will be. Not necessarily strengthening enforcement rights, but making it easier to enforce by making it easier to understand when enforcement is appropriate.
Yeah. One of the areas that I think, I don't know if you'd agree, but Section 101 at least has the reputation for not being clear, even for most patent attorneys don't know where the line is. Is that an area that you think more clarity is needed?
I will actually push back on the idea that Section 101 is particularly unclear. The problem is not that it's unclear. The problem is that in many cases, or some cases, the judges of the Federal Circuit or attorneys don't like what the outcome is. And then you look at the rates at which decisions are overturned or affirmed at the Federal Circuit, and district courts do pretty well on 101. They do pretty comparably to most other areas. I don't think that it's fair to say that 101 is particularly unclear or more unclear than claim construction. So I think that the notion that 101 is a particularly unclear area of law is kind of unfounded, and it's being articulated by people who don't like what the results of the current state of 101 law are. They don't like what is not valid, what is not patentable under the current state of 101. And they say, well, it's not clear what's patentable, when the reality is it's very clear what's patentable in most cases. I don't remember if it was the dissent from en banc, but the notion that we know what is and isn't patentable, we just think this should be patentable and it isn't.
Aren't six of the judges of the Federal Circuit on record saying, no, it's not clear, it's a mess?
I think it's a mess is different from it's not clear. And I think part of the reason it's a mess is because, as you said, six judges on the Federal Circuit disagree with the other six judges. And they don't agree on how the law should be applied. To the extent there's a mess, it's that inconsistent intra-circuit split that creates some of that mess. But I don't think that even six have said it's a mess and it's unclear. I think they've said, we don't like it, we need help. But several of them said, yeah, it's clear, we just don't like the answer.
If six of the judges are approaching it differently from the other six judges, doesn't that inherently make it unclear that depending on the panel that you get, you might get a different outcome?
How is that different than claim construction, where you have the exact same problem? And I don't hear a massive outcry to fix claim construction, although I would probably start there before I addressed 101. In claim construction, we have multiple spheres, splits on the circuit, 6-6, or give or take, about how you apply, whether you read in from the specification or you don't. So it's the same structural issue of the Federal Circuit does not have consensus on the circuit. And that does create a problem with panel dependence. And these are things that the court should resolve, that the Supreme Court should resolve, or at least en banc should be resolved, so that we have more clarity in that sense. But I don't think it's a lack of clarity of what the Federal Circuit has been told. I think it's a lack of consistency among the Federal Circuit on panel opinions. If you give me panel composition, I can tell you more or less what I think the result will be.
But don't you think that's its own kind of problem? Depending on the panel that you get a different outcome. There's like a separate justice system based on, you know, what random judges you're assigned. If you're pan owner A and you get the right three judges, then your panel will survive. If you're pan owner B and you get three different judges, your panel will be found invalid under 101. Don't you think that's maybe even a bigger problem than the lack of clarity?
So I would prefer that the system not work that way, but I don't think that's a problem with the statute. I think that's a problem with the Federal Circuit. And I think that's a problem that they've brought upon themselves.
There might be other problems. The claim construction, you're saying that needs an improvement. Putting that to the side, but don't you think, you know, Section 101 is an area that where you have different outcomes based on who your judges are, even if that's the way to characterize a problem, that should be something that maybe Congress or the Supreme Court should step in to kind of fix that?
So I think that the better method here would be the Supreme Court stepping in to tell the Federal Circuit to knock it off effectively, to give them a little more guidance as to which of these two strains of thought are correct.
Yes. So I want to talk a little bit about the legislative effort in the last Congress. Why do you think it eventually failed?
I think it failed because the people who wanted a change couldn't agree on what the change that they wanted should look like while respecting legitimate equities on the side of people who see value in the current 101 law. At the end of the day, I think it was a problem where even the people who wanted change couldn't agree on what that change should look like. And I think staff got frustrated.
I want to go back to, I guess, the role CCIA plays in patent policy advocacy. Who do you think are the big players, you know, the significant players who are able to kind of make an impact on Capitol Hill? Are there organizations that you think about on both sides?
I mean, obviously, CCIA is the most significant possible organization on Capitol Hill.
Besides CCIA, yes, of course.
No, I think that there are a number of organizations, and it depends on the issue as well. I think that what helps is having a long track record of principled advocacy, of working from the facts, working from reality. And I think that is why CCIA is well regarded. Other organizations like HTIA or Engine is an advocacy organization on behalf of small entities and startups, are both very well regarded. Director Kapos is involved. But I think it's a lot of it is sort of what are the interests and what are your arguments. In my experience, and I should note that before I went to Willmar, I spent a year working for Senator Franken on his Judiciary Committee, not on IP issues. So I actually didn't start out as an IP lawyer. My first lawyering job was in privacy. And then I went into patents. But I think that staff respond well to the argument. They're not as concerned as I think people sometimes assume about who's making the argument. It's what's being argued. What's the evidence for this argument? You know, does this make sense? And understanding, you know, industry has a perspective, and obviously that perspective is going to be understood by the staffer. But it's still useful to know what industry is thinking, in the same way that it's useful to know what the ACLU is thinking, or EFF or any of the other sort of civil society advocacy groups.
The way I view it, you obviously have a blog, and it seems like you're more inclined to publicly state your views, while I think HTIA probably does more work behind the scenes. And that's interesting what you said about maybe it's not so much who says it is, it's who brings those best arguments forward. But what do you think is the most effective way to communicate those arguments to, you know, the decision makers or the staff?
I don't know about Harrity. I don't know about other firms. I know at Wilmer, a lot of our litigators were not engineers, were not technically backgrounded. They were very smart people. They had picked up a lot through litigating. But at the end of the day, they needed to learn about the technology from somebody who probably had a degree in it. So I think with staff, it's the same process. You're educating somebody who's smart. They're not stupid people. They know what they're doing. They know the law, but they have limited time. They don't have the background and the facts that they might want. And your job is to take the time you have with them and give them the background they need and talk to them like smart people who you want to have understand your position. And they will respond. In my experience, at least, staff respond really well to being treated like smart people. So effective advocacy, I think, is really just knowing who your audience is and respecting them and doing your best to communicate your position, even if you disagree. We often disagree with Senator Coons, as an example, but I have a very good relationship with his staff because we've talked over the past years. Phil just left his former staff at this point. Because we've talked and I've given him my understanding of what's going on and our concerns. And it, even if we disagree, it's that respectful disagreement and that willingness to talk about what a legitimate concern is and understanding that there are concerns on both sides that I think is really helpful for effective advocacy.
And I guess that's one aspect of it where you are directly communicating with the staffers. But how do you think about the public communication that you do and the role that plays? What's effective for patent policy specifically?
So in terms of public communication, it's, again, it's knowing your audience. It's like any form of communication. It's who is reading this and what do I want them to take away from it? What background do they have and what lens are they going to look at it through? And then secondarily, you know, sometimes you're writing things just to put the information out there. You know, some of the things that I've published on Patent Progress are there because I did some empirical work to understand, you know, a statistic of some type that I was interested in. And once I had done that, it's good to have that information out there so that A, anybody who's interested can read it, but B, I can refer back to it. And when I'm talking to staff and saying, like, here is what's going on in the PTAB, in the courts, I have that data and I can point to it and say, here's the analysis I did of it, and here is the outcome that I took from it. And they may or may not agree with my analysis, but at least I have something to point to rather than just there's a problem or no, there's no problem. I don't think nobody finds it particularly effective when you just say, well, yeah, there's a problem or no, there's no problem and don't have anything behind that.
And, you know, you mentioned CCIA obviously is focused on other issues. One of them you mentioned is antitrust. But for example, for antitrust, it seems there was way more press coverage of antitrust issues than there's patent issues. How does that play into, I guess, your strategy for advocating on patent issues?
So I think that's just a reflection of the relative interest. Certainly when I've gone into some staffers' offices and explained who I am and what I do when I was meeting them for the first time. And I say, and I work on patents, and you can just see their eyes glaze over because they're not interested. And that's fine.
Yeah.
Not everybody has to be interested in patents. I am, you are, but, and presumably everybody listening to this is. But I think there are some issues that are always going to have broader sort of public appeal. So you'll read about them in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. I think patents, it's more of a specialized audience. It's more of a niche audience. But fortunately, there are lots of really good patent publications, Patent Leo, IP Law 360, Scott Graham's Law.com stuff. There are specialist IP reporters who are great at what they do. And that's really the public communications method. Even if it doesn't go out to as many people, it goes out to the right.
So actually, I want to touch on that because you're the one who broke the news about Senator Leahy becoming chair of the subcommittee. How did you learn about that? What was your impression of that news?
So I can't tell how I learned about it, but I can say that once I learned about it, I asked the person who provided me with the information if it was okay to make it public. And I was told, sure, it's fine. And that's when I went ahead and said, okay, it looks like I'm the first person to say this. Part of the job is talking to people on the Hill, talking to people in the policy community. And honestly, at this point, I don't even remember who I heard it from. But through those connections, we learned about it. And it was an item of interest and some of what I do in the more public communication sphere is sort of patent news, and that fell into the category.
I think it's probably one of the most significant pieces of news, you know, in the patent policy in the last year. He's the chair of his appropriations committee. Why do you think he was interested in pushing Senator Coons aside and taking that role for himself?
I genuinely don't know what the process was, whether it was a seniority thing where Senator Coons had to pick between two subcommittees on two different areas. So I think he took over a different subcommittee in foreign relations, I want to say. I don't know enough about the Democratic committee assignment process to know what led to that change.
And what do you think is the practical impact that Senator Leahy is now the chair of the subcommittee instead of Senator Coons?
I think it's obvious that Senator Leahy and Senator Coons have different views on a number of issues in IP, in particular the IPR system from the Leahy-Smith America Invents Act. Though, as he told us, he didn't name it that. That was Representative Smith at the most recent hearing. He mentioned that. So I think that there's obviously a difference in the guiding direction of the committee. I wouldn't expect to see a stronger Patents Act hearing anytime soon, just guessing here. But it's also an equally divided committee, and Senators Coons and Hirono have both been very vocal advocates for strong patent rights in the past. So I think you'll still see a robust debate on the subcommittee, perhaps less of an emphasis on what we've seen over the past few years in terms of hearings and proposed legislation.
Senator Leahy, I think he had his first hearing about quote-unquote patent quality. What did you think of that hearing?
So I think it was actually the second hearing in the IP subcommittee, because I believe they had one on inventor diversity very soon after he took the gavel. I think it was a good hearing. Quibbles with some of the testimony, but when don't I? It emphasized the importance of sort of, obviously, we don't want to have a patent system where you have to pay $3 million to make sure that your patent goes through the office and we get everything right at the office perfectly. That's not the system that we want. There's a Lemley article from a while back, Rational Ignorance, that suggests that, you know, maybe it's good that we're not doing that level of robust examination at the office. But I think the hearing pointed out that there are impacts of having patents come out of the office that shouldn't have been issued, that are poor quality. And that's what I think, you know, there's always a debate about what a high quality patent is. But I think at the end of the day, it comes down to, would this patent hold up in court? Would this patent hold up in front of the PTAB? Did we find all the relevant prior art? Did we apply the statutory factors properly? And while we wouldn't want to spend $3 million, there is also the argument, and there's a recent article by Michael Frakes and Melissa Wasserman called Irrational Ignorance, that's sort of a decade later response to Lemley, pointing out that we wouldn't want to spend 100 times as much on examination and raise the fees to reflect it. But maybe it would make sense to increase them, to decrease the number of low-quality patents coming out, to decrease litigation costs. And doing that by clearing out the chaff, it makes the patents that do come out that much easier to enforce and that much more valuable, because now they're actually seen as having gone through a stronger process and having more strength. You know, not because we changed the enforcement rights, but because we've cleared away all of the sort of junk patents that everyone kind of looks at and goes, we don't need those.
A few interviews ago, I interviewed Professor Stephen Yelderman, and I think it's fair to say he's skeptical of the patent quality problem. The question that I have, and I'm always curious, you know, I guess that's an easy way to say that there's a patent quality problem because all these patents are getting invalidated at the PTAB, for example. But isn't the flip side of that, well, maybe that's the problem, that high-quality patents are getting invalidated at the PTAB?
I mean, you could make that argument. I don't think it holds up when you look at the PTAB's success rate on appeal. If we're going to assume the Federal Circuit understands the law, and I think it's fair to say that if anyone does, it's them, the PTAB's getting it right. Part of the reason that these are being invalidated at relatively high rates is because the PTAB, it's a selection bias. Its defendants are not going there with every single patent. So you're selecting the ones that you think you have the best option, the best possibility of challenging. And that explains why you would expect to see, you know, more than 50% of patents that go there be invalidated, because the defendants are being selective. And I think that's reflected by the fact that not every patent or even anywhere close to a majority of patents in litigation go into the PTAB.
Another part of his research, I guess, actually looks at how patents are getting invalidated in the district court and the PTAB. And correct me if I'm wrong, my impression was that the goal of a PTAB was really to have a cheaper, quicker alternative to invalidating patents. He looked at it, and at the district court, it's pretty evenly split. Patents getting invalidated based on anticipation. That means, you know, one other reference was out there versus obviousness, multiple references. So it's about 50-50. At the PTAB, it's over 80% of the patents that get invalidated. It's based on obviousness. I think if you talk to practitioners on both sides, they'll say, yeah, at least from what I hear, it's they consider a PTAB friendly to obviousness arguments. Do you think that's a problem that at the end of the day, the PTAB and the district court, how the decisions that they reach are different in that respect?
So I think that it's worth thinking about why district courts have more of an anticipation. And it's not really correct to say district courts here, because usually we're talking about juries. We're talking about jurors who are being asked about validity. And at least from my experience, at least from the work I'd done in trials and from talking to jury consultants and all that, juries don't want to say the patent office got it wrong. They don't feel comfortable doing that. They don't feel comfortable putting together multiple references because they're not experts. Jurors or whoever you find, they're jurors. They're whatever people are in the jury pool. They're not engineers. Some of them might be, but they're not usually engineers. They're not lawyers. They don't have comfort with saying, yeah, the examiner got it wrong. That comes out in the statistics because they really want to see a dead match in the prior art. And that's why you see more anticipation coming out of the district courts. In the PTAB, we have judges with technical training and legal training who are very comfortable with the patent system and who understand what obviousness is, honestly, who feel comfortable saying, yeah, it's fine for a couple references to be put together to combine and make something obvious. And I think that's really the explanation of why there's a difference. So is it a problem that there's a difference? I mean, to the extent that it is a problem, I would say that the problem is that district courts are not comfortable with, or juries are not comfortable with obviousness, but that's a hard problem to fix unless you take the Mark Lemley argument of there is no Seventh Amendment right to a jury on the question of validity, in which case maybe we get bench trials on validity, and maybe then the numbers look much more similar.
Director Iancu made a lot of changes at the PTAB, and I think partially why he made those changes was he thought there was an impression that the PTAB was unfair to patent owners. Do you think it's a problem that there was such an impression? If his changes helped alleviate that impression, do you think that's a good thing?
So I think that the impression was false, to lead it off. I think that the idea that it was biased against patent owners in any meaningful way wasn't correct. And a lot of the changes I think that he made went far too far. We filed comments on the vast majority of them, not generally in favor of them. I think some of them were changes of perception in a lot of ways. I think that, you know, changing to the Phillips standard as opposed to broadest reasonable interpretation, I think it was a poor choice for various reasons. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's had a huge impact other than to maybe help with that perception. But then you have other changes like discretionary denial that have gone so far in the other direction that you've created a reality where the system is effectively biased against challengers, and in particular against challengers who are facing NPE litigation in the Western District, where so many of these denials are relating to.
I mean, I looked at the statistics, and correct me if you've seen different statistics, but I think the institution rates actually from the time Director Iancu became director to the time he left, I think it dropped somewhere by 3% from 60 to 57%. Do you think the concerns about the changes he was making were overblown in light of that?
No, I think that the institution statistics reflect changes over time. And I think that you do see that. I think you're right. I think it was about 3 or 4%. It's not, yeah, it didn't suddenly cut in half. But I think that the difference became why those denials were coming in. It's one thing to be told you can't go to the PTAB because you didn't bring a good case. You made an obviousness argument that wasn't any good. It's very different to be told, well, you know, you have a particularly strong case and you filed it a month after you got sued, but because of the trial date and the timeline, we're just not going to hear it. That's a very different proposition. And that is a real case. There's a reason that I picked those facts. And I think that that's a real problem, that Congress created the system. Congress set out a set of deadlines. And then the PTO said, well, we don't really care what Congress told us to do. We're just not going to do it. That's what the discretionary denial system has become. And I think that is a problem. And if you look at what share of denials are discretionary versus merits, that has changed significantly, even if the top line number hasn't.
Correct me if you disagree, but the original intent was to kind of create a tribunal where it's easier, cheaper, quicker to reach a resolution.
That was part of it, yeah.
If you're forcing litigants, I guess, to be engaged, litigate, I guess, the same patents twice effectively, don't you think kind of defeats the original intent of the PTAB?
I think that in most courts in the country, litigants aren't forced to litigate twice because the court looks at it and says, oh, the PTAB's instituted. I'm going to stay the case until they figure out what they want to do. The parallel litigation track that I think you're referring to only exists in a couple courts that don't want to do stays. And I think that the problem there is that Congress honestly assumed that judges would be inclined to stay. You can see it in the debate over CBM and in the history of the AIA passage. There was a sort of assumption that, yeah, district courts are going to stay these cases once the PTAB is looking at it. They're not going to continue to pursue judicial resources on whether something infringes a patent that might not be valid.
I think me and you agree that the PTAB is a better venue, I guess, to challenge patents than the district court on a practical level, right?
I think on a lot of levels, I think that it's a better venue for the challenge because you have a better decision maker in most cases. You know, the evidence is that it's significantly cheaper across the board. An infringement lawsuit, a full-on patent lawsuit, including the invalidity section, is significantly more expensive than PTAB proceedings, even after those have had their prices go up in the wake of some of the changes made, both in response to Supreme Court decisions, but also in response to Director Iancu's changes in rules. So I think, yeah, we agree that it's a better venue for the challenge. I don't know if we agree that it is a more appropriate venue for the challenge or not.
I guess the only thing that I'm saying is the same way that Judge Albright decides not to stay cases, for example, that could arguably be favorable towards patent owners. Another district court in the Northern District of California, they make decisions to stay their cases for PTAB outcomes that's favorable towards, I guess, the defendants in that case, right?
Well, so I think stays are favorable to everybody, honestly, because, like I said, it's money saving. You figure out if the patent is valid, and then you figure out if it's infringed. That's a monetary savings. I did some analysis on what the value of that is, and it's pretty significant per case. And that savings goes to the patent owner as well, who doesn't have to pay to litigate the infringement on a patent that would ultimately be found invalid.
So would you support stronger estoppel from once PTAB renders their decision to stop the same defendant from then claiming it's invalid on 102 or 103 grounds in the district court based on something new they discover or something like that?
So like every statutory change, my answer is I would have to see the statutory text, but I don't think that that's an impossible proposition. I think that part of doing that would have to be making sure that you could bring all of your challenges in the PTAB. It wouldn't make sense to make that kind of estoppel without making it possible to bring all forms of validity challenge to the PTAB and have them adjudicate all of it at once. It's not out of the question that a stronger estoppel would make sense, but I think it would also probably need to be paired with a full stay provision, a mandatory stay provision, ideally.
A lot of people love using the metaphor of a pendulum swinging in the patent system. I mean, you would agree that during the Trump administration, at least theoretically, it swung towards became more patent-friendly. Where do you see the pendulum swinging now under the Biden administration?
We'll see who winds up as the PTO director. I am eagerly awaiting knowing who that is, as I think everybody is. I think it's coming back. I think the Trump administration, for whatever reason, represented a sort of extreme point in patent policy. And whether it goes all the way back to where it was or part of the way back, I don't know. But I do think that the policies we saw in the PTO at DOJ antitrust and the SEP space, those are not going to be maintained in the same way in the new administration.
And you mentioned Senator Coons, who you worked with his staffers closely. He has a reputation that he's a close friend of Joe Biden. But it seems when it comes to patent issues, is it fair to say they haven't been following what he wants on those issues?
I don't know, honestly. There hasn't been much patent policy by this administration yet outside of the TRIPS waiver. And I think that that's maybe not the best test case for how much President Biden is listening to Senator Coons, given the much wider implications there.
I want to talk a little bit about the dynamics of the next USPTO director. I'm sure you've been following all of this. Senator Tillis releases a letter. Basically, he wants the next USPTO director to continue what Director Iancu is doing. Senator Leahy says, I think shares your views, that Senator Iancu went too far and the next USPTO director needs to undo what Director Iancu did. And Senator Coons, at least my impression is, he's been relatively quiet on patent issues since President Biden became President Biden. But I guess the story that I heard is that he submitted the short list of a White House of acceptable candidates. It seems like, you know, there's some pretty, I imagine some, and Senator Coons, obviously, I think, in some of the legislation he proposed, suggests that he didn't think Iancu's changes went far enough in terms of protecting pet owners. How do you think that will play out?
I genuinely have no idea. I wish I did. I wish I knew who was going to be the next PTO director. But I think that there are very strong views on multiple sides. And at the end of the day, I wonder if it's going to be sort of, it may take a while. I think we may see Drew, acting director Hirschfeld, continue to be the acting director for a time while they look for somebody who is going to be broadly acceptable to both sides of this debate.
Do you think maybe too much attention is paid on who exactly the PTO director is? At the end of the day, you know, I think when Director Kapos was Director Kapos, he wasn't President Kapos. I think what he did as U.S. PTO director was in line with what the Obama administration broadly wanted. Or do you think, is a U.S. PTO director really critical about the policy of the administration?
I think it depends on the administration. I think under the Obama administration, there was probably a more guidance from the administration to the PTO as to what the administration was expecting. And I would expect the same of a Biden administration. Under the Trump administration, I don't know how true that was. I don't know how much guidance was coming from sort of the White House versus saying, okay, Director Iancu, go ahead and do what you think is right. So I think that difference in administrations may be relevant as well, thinking about how the PTO will operate. I do think, yeah, we just had Arthrex, and while I don't expect the director to go out there and overturn on a regular basis decisions coming out of the board, that does provide, I guess, one more layer of importance to who the PTO director is, or at least to the political lobbying over who it's going to be.
I've been reading Penn Progress for a long time. A theme, and correcting me if I'm wrong, that is really the Penn troll problem, right? And that kind of has led to the passage of AIA. I'm thinking Senator Leahy still thinks it's a big problem. But do you think there's something inherently wrong in, I guess, a non-practicing entity or a patent assertion entity, whatever you want to call it, buying patents and then enforcing those patents? Is there something inherently wrong in that? Or is it just the quality of patents that they're doing it with, or the process that they're doing it with, that's a problem?
Do I think there's something wrong with it? Not in a moral sense. It's not murder. It's maybe wrong in the sense of wrong legally in many cases, in terms of you're bringing baseless assertions and maybe sanctions should be more prevalent or awards of fees should be more prevalent. But I think the better question is it actually promoting progress? Does that actually produce future innovation or more future innovation than it would otherwise harm? And there, from everything I can find, from all the research I've done and read, it probably doesn't promote progress. And that, I think, is where the troll problem is. It's not, oh, this is an immoral act. It's, this doesn't help promote innovation.
The other side of argument would be that companies are incentivized to invest billions in research and development because at the end of the day, they'll have those patents to justify that.
If we're talking about a company that's investing billions in R&D to make a product and they're patenting the research they've done, that's a very different discussion than if we have an NPE that's filing additional patents on something where they're not making anything, they're not researching anything, they're just filing additional patents where they've acquired a patent that failed. Yeah, if we have a failed company acquisition patent, you know, from a non-failed company that just got rid of it because they didn't make a product with it, we already have that R&D. The question is, does having that asset exist incentivize future R&D? And the answer is no. Don't have money going back from the most part. You know, small inventors don't get much of the litigation funding. There's studies on this. And in the startup space, VCs don't see having patents to spin off if the company fails as a valuable asset. They do it because it's there. The fact that it's there doesn't mean they're doing it initially. They're not getting those patents because they'll be there at the end. They're selling them off because they happen to get them because they, if it had been a successful company, they would have been able to use those patents to protect their market. And that's where I think the difference between an operating company and an NPE comes in from the sort of future innovation perspective is, for an operating company, they're going to get those patents no matter what. Does it actually harm innovation if there's a working requirement, as an example, that would exclude NPEs, but would permit companies that are making products to provide the sort of competitive exclusion that patents at their core are envisioned as providing.
Do you think there's anything unfair to patent owners in the patent system?
I mean, honestly, I can't think of anything off the top of my head that's unfair to a patent owner in the current system.
Let me throw some things out and you'll tell me.
Sure. I may have been forgetting something. I'm not saying I can think of everything.
At least what I hear is it takes too long and too much money to enforce a patent.
I mean, it takes a couple years and it's expensive. I can't deny that, but that's litigation. I don't know how to fix that without fixing the problem of lawyers cost money. And I don't think that's unfair to patent owners. I think that's just a fact of life that litigation is expensive. I don't think that they should be provided with the right to go, okay, you infringe my patent and we just have to assume they're right. Even if that was the case, that wouldn't be fair to patent owners. That would be an absurdity. But I think that some of the things that we've talked about in terms of you can make enforcement easier by making the patent right clearer, maybe you'll have fewer patent rights, but the ones that do exist will be clearer and easier to enforce because you'll understand what is enforceable and what isn't. In litigation, the expense is really in the judgment calls. It's not hard to enforce a patent that's clearly valid and clearly infringed because somebody's going to look at that and say, oh, I'll take a license to that because I'm going to lose. It's when there's a judgment call and you're on the border, that's when it's hard to enforce. And that's where the concerns about litigation time and cost come in.
There's an organization on the flip side of CCIA maybe in the policy debates, and that's U.S. Inventors. And they're made up of good faith innovators. They devoted their time, they took risks, they got patents. And then my impression is they feel that a rug has been pulled under them with PTAB and some of the other changes in patent law. How do you explain their view of the patent system?
Well, so some of them, I don't understand why they think that there's a problem because they're complaining about things that their patents have never been subjected to. They just assume, well, the PTAB exists, so my patent would be invalidated if I asserted it. I'm not sure that's true. And if it is true, I wonder about what your patent actually is and how valid it would be. Others, I question the statements they're making. I'm thinking of Josh Malone here. He won a $30-plus million judgment. I know he said he spent a fair amount on lawyers, but look, I was at a very expensive law firm working for large clients, and I cannot think of cases where that much money was spent other than maybe like Apple, Samsung. But $30 million is a lot of legal fees. It just comes off a little almost disingenuous to hear somebody complain, oh, you know, the system is terrible and it doesn't work when it worked for them.
I guess that is a good example. You know, like this isn't somebody who is a Beltway plant who was put out there to kind of have this story. He actually went through it where, you know, he quit his job. He took an enormous risk. It's like the great American story. He built this company, this made-for-TV company, just copies it and basically tells them, well, you could try to sue us, but you're not going to win because we're just going to keep litigating until you run out of money and give up. I mean, isn't that kind of the example of maybe the patent system isn't working, the fact that a defendant can take that kind of position and get away with it?
So I'm not going to defend. I didn't follow the Telebrands litigation that closely to know what they had said. If they said, you know, we're going to litigate it whether or not it's valid and we're never going to pay you, it's the defensive equivalent of, you know, the MPHJs of the world that are out there just throwing out assertions. That's not helpful behavior either, but I think that that's not most litigants. Most litigants are looking at it and saying, you know, assuming you got a demand letter before you got a lawsuit filed against you, which is no longer a guarantee, they're looking at what was sent and saying, okay, we're going to take a look at this and we'll get back to you. When it's a clear case, they're going to license or they're going to say no. It's not about, oh, we're going to litigate this until you're in the dust. It's, we don't think that we infringe and we're not going to pay you. Not to pick on Josh Malone, but I think he, of all people, would understand. He got sued by somebody who claimed he stole the idea for a bunch of balloons from them. And when you develop something yourself, I think that it's almost offensive to have somebody come and say, well, you stole my idea. And I think he would understand that.
I think I would agree with you that, or I think there's broad agreement, for example, bad faith actors who send out demand letters knowing their patents are bad, trying to collect money, that's bad. I guess I would put it that way. Do you think on the flip side of that, you know, let's say a company that knows that it's using technology from another company but refusing to settle a patent owner, is that attention, more attention should be paid to that kind of behavior and discouraged?
So when you say using technology from another company, do you mean they developed it and that other company said, we have a patent on this? Or do you mean they went, found the patent and took it? Because those are very different scenarios.
Well, here's an example. Let's say it's a big company and they're collaboratively working with a startup and then they stop working with them. And I think there's a lot of examples like that. They stop working with them and then go on to quote unquote independently develop on their own. The startup gets upset and tries to enforce its patent rights. And the bigger tech company says, well, we don't need to settle because we'll just fight it out.
So I think everybody deserves a right to defend themselves in court. I'm a lawyer in that way. And at the end of the day, like, I wasn't in the room. Maybe they did independently develop, maybe they didn't. But I'm not going to say you're not allowed to defend yourself. I think that that's a fundamentally improper way to think about anything.
There's a stark divide in the perception about how the patent system is working. You know, I talked to friends who, represent mostly defense and patent litigation. They have a completely different view from other lawyers who represent patent owners or a mix of that. Why do you think that is?
I think everybody identifies with their clients. And at the end of the day, if you mostly work for defendants, you're going to have some identification with how they must feel having these terrible patents brought to them and saying, you owe us money for them. And you look at them and you're like, we don't do this. And it's not valid in the first place. And on the flip side, if you mostly work with plaintiffs, I'm sure there's the identification with nobody wants to pay us for these clearly valid, clearly infringed patents. It's very understandable that the side you mostly represent is going to influence how you look at the system.
I was looking at the about section of Patent Progress, and you talk about some of the ridiculous patents that are out there, and you list making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, method of swinging a swing, and exercising a cat with a laser pointer. All those three patents, you know, there are 3 out of 11 million patents, 90s or early 2000. So has the patent system improved? If these are the kind of the same examples that we're still talking about all these years later, I guess 10 years after AIA and so forth, can we say it's improved, it's gotten better, declare victory in some way?
I won't declare victory. I will say it's absolutely gotten better. I think there was definitely a low point hit in the turn of the millennium era where those patents that you mentioned came from. And I think we have gotten better since then. I think there have been changes in law and changes in statute in the AIA that have improved things. But I won't say that these are all gone. There was the method of yoga filming from a couple of years back, which basically amounted to have a camera in the middle of the class. So I don't think that these sort of bad patents don't exist anymore. I think that everybody just refers back to those because they're the known examples. But I do think things have improved.
And I was going to talk about one of those examples because I said, really? An examiner gave a patent for making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And when you dig into it, it turns out that, you know, the company that owned it is Smucker's, not an NPE. Really, it's about how you package them in a way for them to last long. Smucker's actually made a product based on that, which I'm sure made thousands of, you know, parents' lives significantly easier and happier and so forth. If the system is really that bad, you know, why do we need to characterize that patent to say, well, it was for a method of making a peanut jelly, sandwich, not say it was for a new packaging of peanut butter and jelly sandwich that we don't think was innovative enough in our idea?
So I think part of it is the specialist-generalist divide. And I've talked to people about this kind of defending patents where you see a patent with an incredibly ridiculous title, and then you look at the claims and it's something perfectly reasonable. This may have been an example. I didn't write the peanut butter and jelly posts, so I can't speak to that one. But sometimes the claims do define something much narrower, and maybe it's not as ridiculous as it seems at first glance. But at the same time, like, it's great that Smucker's came up with this advance in packaging.
The title is Sealed Crustless Sandwich. That was the title of the patent.
Oh, is this the Uncrustables? Speaking as the parent of a very energetic 3.5-year-old, I am sure I will be very grateful for this innovation in the next few years.
There you go.
I'll leave it with the counter question of, wouldn't they have come up with this even if they couldn't patent it? I think the answer is yes. I think if I'm Smucker's and I say, oh, I can come up with this product, I'm going to sell it on branding. And yes, people will buy store brands the same as they buy store brands of anything. They'll buy the Safeway brand of Uncrustables. And at this point, I think there probably is a Safeway brand of Uncrustables. I don't know how old that patent is. But some people still buy Eggos instead of store-brand waffles because they prefer them. Branding matters. And I think that with some of these innovations, yeah, they're new. Are they really not obvious? I don't know. But do we really need a patent to generate them?
Yeah, I didn't dig deep into this, but I'm looking, it was filed by another company. They acquired it. I'm guessing some independent inventor came up with this invention of making these sandwiches. It would have taken some kind of investment on the part of Smucker's to do that. I'm guessing they paid for either the patent or that company. And that was a foundation for that, for a foundation of the fact that somebody spent time coming up with that idea, a foundation that somebody bringing that company to Smucker's and having them acquired. That's just my guess. And yeah, there's a good chance they wouldn't have made it to market if they didn't know that there was some kind of IP protecting their investment in that.
I don't know. Ultimately, you know, it's a hard counterfactual to prove. But again, it's just, do we need a patent to generate this innovation, or would this innovation have happened on its own? And that's kind of the fundamental question of where we draw the line of what should and shouldn't be patentable. And I'm not saying I know all the answers to that question. I don't think anyone does.
Yeah, it's a hard counterfactual, and I think it'd be interesting to look into more. But it seems in this case, it didn't need a patent. There was a patent before the product came to market. And I guess, at least in this story, we kind of at least know that chronology. All right, so I want to ask one last question. There's a lot of patent attorneys out there, not a lot of patent attorneys that do what you do. What advice would you give to a young lawyer who wants to be the next Josh Landau, work on patent policy issues?
So I would give them a few pieces of advice. I would say yes. The reason that I wound up in my job in a very real way is because during 3L, my trademarks and copyright professor emailed me and said, hey, they're setting up a new subcommittee and they're looking for law clerks. Would you be interested? And this was the privacy technology and the law subcommittee at the time. And I said, yeah, that sounds like fun. I'll do that. And that is how I wound up working for the Judiciary Committee, for the Privacy Technology and the Law Subcommittee. And that is how I gained some experience in sort of the policy world. That is also how I wound up at WilmerHale, the chief counsel there in that office. It was a Wilmer alum, and he basically said, I can't hire you, but I can send your resume over. Wound up there. So saying yes led to my career, to this offhand thing. But I think that's more just general career advice. Say yes to opportunities. Try things, even if you're not 100% sure. And secondarily, like, it's hard to get work in policy without having worked in policy. If you're interested in this, try and find roles in government. Try and find roles on the Hill to know some level of what the policy sphere is like. And then just keep an eye out for the jobs and explain why you're interested in doing it. Explain why you want to be involved in policy.
That's great advice, Josh. Thank you so much for joining and for having this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Or if you'd like to learn more about my firm, visit HeritageLLP.com.